Welcome back to the Gardening with Joey and Holly radio show. Hydration problems? Never again when you use the tree diaper.
Before tree diaper, let's be honest, watering trees, shrubs, and bushes was not your favorite job on your property. But with tree diaper, it's not really a job. Tree diaper is a revolutionary watering system that slowly releases stored rainwater when plants need it. The tree diaper is filled with water from rain or when you water and slowly releases water over 3 weeks. No pipes, hoses, or electricity needed. Whether you're a first-time gardener or advanced, tree diaper will improve the way you water your plants. Every time it rains, tree diaper recharges. Made in the USA. Check out all the sizes they have available at treediaper.com. That's treediaper.com.
It is as easy as we say it is. We've got some videos on that on our website, the wisconsinvegetablegardener.com, our parent website. You can search tree diaper, and it is really that easy. It takes the guesswork out of everything. Well, Holly, we're going to talk about here the history of canning. Now, this could be an hour or 2 hour long PBS special, you know, fundraising video that or an episode you'd see on PBS. But we're going to try to knock it down in about 14 minutes to give you the basics, because we all can, but we maybe not understand where all this and how all this came to be. So,
and then on December 1st of 2004, yeah. Okay.
Ben walked into his kitchen and saw the pickle setting over the... Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so this goes back to 1795.
Okay.
So Napoleon, you know who Napoleon is?
Yeah, I know who Napoleon is. Yeah.
He's like...
Great movie.
Right, Napoleon says, I want to offer a reward of 12,000 francs for the invention of a new food preservation method. So so he wanted to have some food preservation going on.
Yeah, so he could have stuff anytime.
Yeah. So then finally in 1809, somebody named Nicholas Apert wins his Napoleon reward, and he comes up with this book, writes this book. It finally got published in 1920, but it's called The Book for All Households, The Art of Preserving Animal and Vegetable Substances for Many Years.
Okay.
Many years. So I looked through this book. You can find it online.
Okay.
And it's stuff like, it's basically like
is
canning.
Is it worth the read, or is it a snooze fest?
It's a snooze fest.
Okay.
I didn't find any pictures. But so it's stuff like salting meats and then placing them between two plates. And then wrapping like
twine. To a certain degree, some of the things that we read about in the Bible of how in the Old Testament how they preserved things through the season.
But then it's stuff like putting fruit into sugar and making like a jam, and then there's stuff like boiling and making like a seal with into jars or bottles.
What modern day we know as
right. Yeah. So it's definitely like a basis of canning and food preserving.
In this book that was a snooze fest, it didn't tell you how many thousands of people died from eating bad food until they figured out how to get this thing right, did it?
No.
Okay. And I joke about that, but there is a certain
level.
We're
going to talk about
that. Okay. Go ahead.
In 1810, Peter Durand, he creates the tin canister for commercial canning. And there's a book that you could read. It's called The Canning of Peas. I didn't read this. I didn't look for this book. But it came out in 1909, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Bureau of Chemistry.
Okay.
In 1812, this person opens the first cannery. This is more of the industrial canning.
The tin cans that you see on the shelf.
Yeah.
Then we jump to 1858, where now we're familiar with the name John L. Mason. Patents the Mason jar.
He makes a Mason jar. Yep, that's correct. So there's that.
1884, the Ball Corporation starts manufacturing the glass jars in which we are familiar with. The Kern Home Canning Book. The Kern Home Canning Book.
Well, first.
Okay.
I think we got kind of mixed up here. Elizabeth Kerr, or Alexander Kerr, made the Kerr Glass Manufacturing Corporation to start the home canning supply business.
So we had the Ball and we had the Kern.
Right. So then we'll go back to the 1945. Right. I don't know how that
now as you get going on this, people now today, Ball owns Kern.
Yeah.
And I see these comments, I'm not buying a Ball product ever again, I'm only buying Kern. Well, Kern's been out of business technically, and Ball bought them out. So whenever you buy anything, you're all putting money in the same pocket. So there are some independent jar manufacturers and lid manufacturers, but for the most part, there you go.
I think like Golden Harvest.
Golden Harvest is one of them, yeah. 1914.
So this is when home demonstrations, agents at work in the field. So basically, home canning went to like the 4-H clubs. The USDA started to encourage people to learn how to home can. 1917, the USDA says that pressure canning is the only way to safe process low acid foods.
Which is still true today.
Yes. So here's a little bit of a morbid history.
Okay.
In 1931, 12 people, including some children, die after consuming improperly home canned food at a dinner party in North Dakota.
Oddly that that's documented like that.
It's, yeah, well, whatever. This is from the USDA website.
Okay.
So that's how it's documented. Okay, so 1939, World War II begins, and at that point, there was a peak in home canning in the early 40s, and because of the shortages of the food,
Victory Gardens,
things like that. And so there was more than 4 billion cans and jars processed during the time of World War II.
Now, side note, the blue or the the light blue jars that we're familiar with were manufactured between 1896 and 1937. And the font on the jar will identify the decade in which that jar was made. So there's a nice little handy tip there when you're looking at jars. And the other question people get asked is, how much is my blue jar worth? It's worth however much somebody's willing to pay you. There's not really, unless you get the purple ones or the brown ones, those are the big, that was like the 1870s, 1880s, somewhere in there. That's where the big money's at. The typical blue jar that we see, there's really just, it's whatever somebody's willing to pay. That's pretty much the value of what that jar is because so many were made.
Right. So then there was a lull in the canning. So what had happened was after the war, people started going back to work. And then
life got back to normal.
Right. Life got back to normal. And then the refrigerator became very popular. And this is where people are like, I don't need to preserve my food. I got this ice box. Like literal ice box.
Right.
Yeah. So, but then in the 1970s, the do-it-yourself boom, probably the first do-it-yourself boom happened. I don't know what sparked this. I guess we'd have to do more research on that. But then people started buying canners again, and they got back into canning.
Well, and for the homesteader, for the farmer, for the country people, canning never went out of style. This is what you did. You planted a big garden. You preserved as much as you could, put up for the winter. And you knew how many quarts of this or quarts of that you needed in order to get you back through the winter into the next growing season.
Yeah. And that's why when you told me I was going to can, I said I thought canning was only for country folk.
And you were wrong.
I was wrong. I am not country folk.
No.
Okay. So then in the 80s, 1988 to be exact, the USDA came out with their first published guide. It was called The Complete Guide to Home Canning. And I'm sure you could probably find that at your local library to this day.
Right. And 1993, the Food and Drug Administration published its first comprehensive food code poster illustrating improper canning procedures. The don'ts, the 1943, back then they kind of did things and then we reversed a lot of stuff then.
Yeah, it's like don't get distracted.
Follow the instructions. Yeah. You can't omit certain ingredients. You have to use everything in which it's listed for the signs to be precise and to make the food safe to eat.
Don't overstuff the jars.
Mm-hmm.
Don't start a fire. Things like that. So that is, so that's kind of the history of canning.
And now we'll talk about kind of the different types of jars. My grandparents and probably some of you are old enough to remember or did partake in many of the preserving items were canned in half-gallon jars. Now you are it's advised not to can anything in half-gallon jars except for grape juice and apple juice because the core temperature of the jar, the material in the jar, cannot get to a high enough safe level of heat in order to kill the bacteria that can be harmful to you. Then the quart jar became the more popular jar for some smaller families or single households. Pint jars or half pint jars became a norm. And then there's the wire clasp, and now we know we've got the two piece lid. We had the zinc lid, and all of that. So the jars have progressed over the years from colors to different types of lids to much safer than what our parents, our grandparents, and our great-grandparents dealt with. But back then, they probably didn't know that what they were doing wasn't safe because they kind of did what they needed to do to survive.
And I think a lot of it was is just technology,
right,
and word of mouth and food safety guidelines, mm-hmm. things like that. And the zinc lids, those, I think the zinc lids are cool, but it makes sense why there's the two-piece lids these days.
Right. Are you familiar how the zinc lid actually worked in the process? Okay. There was a rubber gasket that went on top of the actual glass jar, and then you cranked the zinc lid down, and somehow it sealed, and there it went. Now, in Europe, they still use the wire clasp and a rubber gasket, because they call it jarring over there. They don't call it canning. It's called jarring.
Yeah.
And then we've got, many of you may have collections of jars, either passed down that you use or that are decor or novelty items that you have collected or been given. We've got a number of those in the studio. We've got a 4-gallon jar. Yes, a 4-gallon jar. We've got a 2-gallon jar. We've got a 1-gallon jar. Now, these are the 1-gallon jar is not the new one that they came out. These are glass jars with the wire clasps that mimic old traditional canning jars, but have a much larger quantity to them, not for canning usage, simply for decorative purposes. And we are still trying to confirm or eliminate the possibility that Ball made a 3-gallon jar. We've got a half pint, quart, half gallon, 2-gallon, and 4-gallon. And my common sense would say, why did Ball not have a 3-gallon jar? If they made a 1, 2, and 4, you would think they would have a 3. So if you can help us out with that, since we have the platform to reach a lot of you, give us a email at gardentalkradio@gmail.com and let us know if you know for a fact if Ball Canning made a novelty 3-gallon jar. We would sure like to know. So the history of canning, it wasn't quite what maybe you thought we were going to go through. We went through from all the way from 1795 to present day to kind of tell you the stepping stones of where and how it all began to what we are currently aware of today. And the National Home for Food Preservation recommends on the recipes, what time frame is it safe to use a recipe when you have a book, or what's the guidelines on that?
Basically 2005 or sooner.
Okay.
So that's when they kind of last changed their standards.
Within about 15 years.
But yeah, 15 years, they kind of, because food has changed, just growing conditions and things like that. So
the nutrient value of food has changed. Yeah.
Even just like tomatoes, you used to not have to add acid to your tomatoes, and now you do because of acidity levels and all that stuff. So yes.
It changes with the safety of it. And So keep that in mind. If you've got an old classic Ball canning book, keep it around. Put it in a shadow box, whatever you want to do. But it would not be safe to use those recipes. And I understand, I know there's some of you out there going, well, I've used this since 1968, and I haven't got sick. And Holly, your response to that is?
Well, that's okay if you want, but I wouldn't take any chances.
Right. Good for you.
I practice safe canning. We practice safe canning. That's what we encourage people to do. So I'm not going to tell you yes or no.
Can at your own risk.
Right.
Well, summer's over. Holly, nights are getting colder. Days are getting chillier. Kids are back in school. And the lawn has been forgotten. And if we forget about the lawn, those Japanese beetles will guarantee be there for next spring to attack everything you've got growing.
Yeah, just because it's fall, we don't want to forget about our yards and those Japanese beetles either. They may be gone, but they're not far. Not only do they feast on your roses and berries this summer, they laid eggs in your turf so they can start again next year. You can take a stand with Phylum's GrubGon. GrubGon is a non-chemical BT granular that specifically targets scarab pests and their larvae. Simply apply the granular with a spreader or irrigate into the soil and let the naturally occurring bacteria do its job.
Not only is GrubGon easy to use, it's the only non-chemical choice, effective for controlling grubs. And the best part about it is non-toxic to bees and other beneficial pollinators, so you don't have to worry about them picking up any toxicity, taking it back to their hive, and killing the hive. You can find all this out and get a hold of some Grub Gone from Phylum Bioproducts, the natural choice. That's Phylum Bioproducts.
For more information, please visit thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.